Welcome to A Hard Look, the Administrative Law Review podcast from the Washington College of Law. We'll discuss how administrative law impacts your daily life, from regulatory actions by agencies and the litigation over them to the balance of power among branches of the government. This is A Hard Look.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sarah Knarzer, and I am the host of A Hard Look. I'm very excited to be sitting here today with our guest, Richard Blau. Mr. Blau is a shareholder with the law firm of Gray Robinson, where he chairs the Alcohol, Beverage, and Food Law Department and heads the firm's nationwide alcohol industry team. He is an elected member of the American Law Institute and is a member of the Florida Bar, the New York Bar, the DC Bar, the American Bar Association, and the Federal Bar Association. Mr. Blau has served for over 8 years as the chairman of the ABA's Committee on Beverage Alcohol Practice, and in 2019, he was elected to the National Conference of Liquor Administrators, NCSLA, Hall of Fame. Mr. Blau lectures on 21st Amendment issues and writes extensively on alcohol-related legal matters. Welcome to A Hard Look, Mr. Blau.
Thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Yeah, I'm really excited. And just in case any of our listeners didn't gather from your bio, you're basically an expert on alcohol regulation, right?
Well, I've devoted several decades to what I consider to be a fascinating area of law.
That's awesome. How does one get into alcohol and beverage law exactly?
There could be a myriad of ways. I fell into it because I was a trial lawyer and I was asked by the Guinness Import Company to defend a case in Florida, where the state legislature had just passed a law that was very, very favorable to beer wholesalers, but it really took a great deal of challenge to the manufacturers and suppliers of those products in terms of skewing the playing field and giving the wholesalers a variety of different rights and privileges that manufacturers felt were unfair. Long story short, the case wound up making new law and exposed me to something I certainly had never studied in law school, and that is the unique area of alcohol regulation and legislation in the United States.
Yeah, it definitely seems very niche and unique. Do you just want to kind of expand on sort of, the size and the importance of this area of law?
Yeah, I find it to be a fascinating area for several reasons. First of all, it is a collection of every influence and input that you could think of: history, politics, economics, morals, the social order, medical issues, taxation issues. They're all part and parcel of how policy is made with regard to the regulation of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And it's a fascinating dynamic that has really spanned over 80 years since the repeal of prohibition in 1933 in this country. And if you really want to deeply understand how alcohol has been regulated and how it has actually contributed to our nation's history, you can go back in time to before the United States even was the United States, mm-hmm. because alcohol was an important part of how the colonies established themselves. A lot of people don't realize, but in the early days of North America, there were no treasuries printing currency or distributing coinage. A lot of the so-called New World economy was based on barter. And alcohol, it turns out, was one of the most promising products to barter in terms of its permanence and in terms of the public's desire for it.
Yeah, that's not surprising to me at all.
And it shouldn't be surprising that today, when you ask about the size and importance of the industry, it's typically divided up into segments: the beer segment, the wine segment, the distilled spirits segment. Every segment in the American economy is in excess of $1 billion. These are multi-billion dollar industries that contribute mightily to the American economy, both in terms of domestic production, domestic employment, domestic taxation, foreign exports to other countries. It's really an amazingly important, and as I said, it's a fascinating industry to work with.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, things are constantly changing, and it just sounds like there would never be a dull moment at all.
No, there's never a dull moment. And from a lawyer's point of view, no day is going to be the same as the previous day. One of the challenges associated with alcohol regulation is that because of the history And because of the unique nature of the product and its impact on the people who consume it, alcohol is regulated in the United States at the federal level. Mm-hmm. As a result of the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, that's the one that repealed prohibition in 1933, it is also regulated by every individual state with regard to the alcohol industry within the operations of the state's boundaries. And mm-hmm. in some of those states, authority even extends down to localities to regulate the industry. So from a lawyer's point of view, you're dealing with federal law, you're dealing with state law, at times you're dealing with local laws. Depending on if you're involved with importers or exporters, you may be dealing with international law and trade agreements. It is truly a fascinating area to work in.
And so in your opinion, is there really any other industry to compare it to?
It is certainly very unique. I will say that. There are aspects of this, like I said before, Sarah, that I was mm-hmm. never exposed to in law school. You know, mm-hmm. I grew up, as probably most of your listeners did, believing that we live in a laissez-faire economy, a free market. We have antitrust laws that prohibit price collusion and fixing prices. But in the alcohol industry, you will find laws that mandate minimum pricing in some states, laws mm-hmm. that require industry members to post pricing and maintain those prices and publish the prices to all the other industry members. There are exclusive marketing territories. That was part of what my first litigation experience in this industry entailed. And I remember reading that thinking, wait a minute, this is completely backwards from everything that I was taught in law school. What is going on? And then, of course, most people will recognize, I think, just through their personal experience, that even today in this country, there exist certain wet areas where alcohol can be produced mm-hmm. and commercially transacted. But there are dry areas where the laws say, not that you can't drink, but like original prohibition in 1920 to 1933, there cannot be any industry commercializing alcohol within the jurisdiction that's deemed to be dry. And many states still have dry areas. A lot of your listeners probably would be surprised to hear that although prohibition was repealed in 1933, states were still given the option to stay dry or to go wet. And the state of Mississippi, the last state to repeal its statewide dry prohibition laws, didn't do so until 1966. Hard to believe, but you know, even today, there are areas that are dry. And within states, there are areas that are wet and dry, and sometimes they coexist in the same community. So, you know, that's pretty unique. I can't really point to any industry that I think would come close. In terms of regulation and the burdens of regulation and the complexity of regulation, I do think that food and food law is an mm-hmm. area that's becoming more and more complex and more governed not only by federal law, but also by state law. In fact, it used to be entirely by state law, and now the federal government is becoming more actively engaged. Actually, from about the turn of the late 19th to early 20th century, people may remember stories about the muckrakers and about Theodore Roosevelt as president and the food laws that were passed because of the horrible conditions in meat processing facilities in Chicago and the stockyards and all of that. Food law is, I think, coming close, but nowhere near comparable to alcohol law. Maybe an area that does bear some scrutiny and could ultimately prove to be a lot like alcohol is the emerging legalization of cannabis. Mm-hmm. In fact, when states like Washington State, Colorado, Oregon first decided to legalize recreational marijuana in their respective states, they actually looked to their state alcohol agencies for guidance and support in trying to figure out how best to regulate the product. So there's a comparison there.
Yeah. I think that's really cool. And it's also my understanding that a case on alcohol regulation was just in the Supreme Court. Can you tell us about that?
That's the Tennessee Wine and Spirits Retailers Association versus Thomas case. And you're right. It was just decided this past term. It represents the sort of the successor case to a decision that was decided in 2005, Granholm versus Heald. Both of those cases get a great deal of attention from the alcohol industry because in each, the Supreme Court is actually focusing on what it means to regulate alcohol and how you balance the powers granted by the 21st Amendment to the states, which already had inherent police powers, and how you balance that against the emerging dormant commerce clause doctrine, which is really a proponent of the notion that, look, let's not let states burden the ability of commerce to cross state lines when it is not appropriate to impose such a burden. That's a balancing test that's vitally important to the alcohol industry. There are many in the industry that would love to see a national market for alcohol without regard to state borders. There are many in the United States that feel state and even local regulation of alcohol is paramount. And the last thing that they want to see is retailers from one state selling directly to consumers in another state and bypassing the elaborate regulatory systems that a state may have in place to try and regulate alcohol within its borders. So what Tennessee Wine and Spirits did is, I think, in a sense, the majority stuck to a lot of what Granholm versus Heald had handed down in 2005, which is to say that the dormant clause, dormant commerce clause doctrine is entitled to careful consideration. The 21st Amendment does not empower state regulators with impunity. Tennessee Wine and Spirits made a point through Justice Alito's majority opinion of saying, look, you states may have a legitimate purpose for the regulation that you're imposing on the industry that has somehow restricted them to the point that they're now litigating this and challenging the constitutionality of that regulation, but you've got to be able to have what Alito called concrete evidence. And that's a step beyond what Granholm had emphasized, the point that we are no longer going to take for granted, as Justice Brandeis did in the mid and later 1930s, shortly after the 21st Amendment had been passed, when some alcohol cases were brought to the Supreme Court to try and probe the parameters of the new amendment. And Brandeis, being the brilliant jurist that he was, he said, look, the 21st Amendment is clear on its face. It means what it says. States have the authority to regulate. And if they pass a regulation, then that's it. End of story. Well, over the course of time, that concept has been challenged as more complexity came to the industry, more challenging questions, you know, balancing, say, the 21st Amendment against the First Amendment, speech rights, commercial speech rights. And of course, the 21st Amendment against the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. And Tennessee Wine and Spirits Retail Association basically says you've got to go through the several steps of our analysis to determine under the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine whether this is an undue burden. You know, do you have a legitimate purpose? Is the regulation properly tailored to achieve that purpose? Does it, in fact, in some level of degree, achieve that purpose? It's not the strict scrutiny test, but it is a test that requires you to have concrete evidence to show that, yes, this isn't just a make-believe, you know, rule or regulation or restriction that is secretly has no value other than protecting local interests from out-of-state competitors. It does have legitimate purpose, and it does move towards achieving those legitimate objectives. And that's where I think Tennessee came out. They did hold in favor of the challengers, but the statute in question was a very poorly drafted statute that required not just a presence, that licensees who sell alcohol have a brick and mortar presence in Tennessee, but they had to have a durational residence in the state. And the state of Tennessee never produced really any evidence to show why that was relevant, much less important to achieving a legitimate objective. A really interesting thing about Tennessee Wine and Spirits is that while it was much awaited and much scrutinized when the decision was issued, there have been two significant alcohol decisions from federal appellate courts after Tennessee Wine and Spirits. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing, Sarah, is that neither of those decisions referenced Justice Alito's analysis or the case at all. One of those decisions involved the decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in the Lebemoff Enterprises, Inc. versus Whitmer case, Whitmer being the governor of Michigan. That was a case where challengers from Indiana, who were a conglomerate of retailers and wanted to sell alcohol to Michigan consumers across the state border without getting a license in Michigan, challenged the Michigan law that said, no, that's not the way we do things. In our state, alcohol has to flow through what's called the traditional three-tier system. A source of supply has to sell it to a licensed wholesaler. A licensed wholesaler has to sell it to a licensed retailer. The licensed retailer sells it to Michigan consumers. And Lebemoff, according to the Michigan law, could not just sell directly to Michigan consumers from his base in Indiana. Case went up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and they decided that Michigan had a very legitimate basis for wanting its alcohol to flow through the three-tier system, and that was good enough for the court. It really didn't go into the kind of substantive, concrete evidence analysis that you could argue Tennessee Wine and Spirits required. Some detractors of the decision are saying that the court just took it on face value, that a three-tier system of alcohol regulation is by definition sufficient to justify regulations that require compliance with it, and that was that. Likewise, in Texas, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit upheld a decision in the Walmart versus Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission case, upheld it in the sense that they upheld a Texas alcohol law that says no publicly traded company can be a licensee for alcohol commercialization in the state. The interesting thing about that case, Sarah, is that the law had a grandfather exception. And in Texas, the factual record showed that there were, there was such an extensive amount of grandfathered activity in Texas that it really begged the question of how can you say this law is even achieving any level of what you claim it's intended to do when you have so many licensed actors who are publicly traded companies in the industry, all operating under the claim that, well, we're grandfathered in. It's sort of the notion that the exceptions outnumbered the rule so that the rule was ineffective. And that's really the basis of what the challengers argued. But the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, again, looking at the legislative history of Texas laws and their you know, very, very affirmative embracement of the three-tier system and insistence that Texas is wedded to the three-tier system, won the day without any reference to Tennessee Wine and Spirits or any of the analysis that Justice Alito and the majority in that decision argued were necessary in order for regulators to prevail over the dormant commerce clause doctrine.
Interesting. So this stuff is, I mean, really changing and happening in real time. And it's kind of a lot to keep up with. Are there any sort of national shifts in approaching this case law?
There is a strong movement to embrace technology and to utilize e-commerce and to reach out to consumers directly. You know, our pandemic has certainly boosted that activity. And there are elements of the industry who say now more than ever, we need to do away with these archaic post-prohibition laws that never envisioned an ability to connect with consumers as directly as e-commerce and the internet and online activity allow for, and that the sale of alcohol should be allowed to take advantage of that. There are others who, as I said before, are equally passionate that that is just the wrong way to go. It opens up a great many can of worms. It's going to doom us to repeat the evils of the old saloon era that gave rise to ultimately prohibition in the first place. We don't want to go down that road. We shouldn't be changing what has worked so well for so many generations. I think you have hit on a good point, though, that what's going on in the world today, the coronavirus, the spread of the pandemic, the way it's changing life in America, is having a significant impact on the alcohol industry, which in turn may weigh in on this debate over whether the regulation of the industry should change.
Yeah, I just like to talk about Corona for a second. Before I started law school, I used to work at this restaurant that was really known for its tacos and for its margaritas. And one of the things that I did as a hostess was I always kept an eye on our really nice patio areas, because you'd always have people who would be drinking a few margaritas and they'd have like one too many to the point where they just decide to try to walk right off the patio with it in their hand, which can get them in a lot of trouble, and it could also get the restaurant in a lot of trouble. So part of my job was to chase them down and kind of rein them in and keep them all in the area where they were permitted to drink. And you know, just a few weeks ago, I went and I ordered food takeout from them, and I got, you know, the typical burrito, tacos, chips and salsa. And I also just grabbed two margaritas from them and took them right from the window where you pick it up right into my car and put them in the little cup holders and drove home with two margaritas from this restaurant. So I just think that's a really good illustration of like how much things are changing, at least where I am in Virginia, because I know it's different in a lot of places. And yeah, I guess it's just part of what they're doing to keep small businesses and restaurants in action.
You think correctly, Sarah. That's exactly what's going on now, and it may wind up being the engine for change. Okay. I mentioned earlier the industry is divided basically into three tiers: the supplier tier, wholesale tier, the retail tier. Within the retail tier, typically the divide is between the off-premise retailer, like a liquor store or a grocery store, somewhere where you buy alcohol, but you don't intend to drink it there. You're going to take it somewhere else, maybe to home, maybe to a party, maybe somewhere else, and you're going to consume it off the premises, the licensed premises. The other side of the retail tier is the on-premise side of the tier. That's your restaurant, your bar, your nightclub, places where you buy alcohol there at the licensed premises, and you consume it there. And the thing about the pandemic is that it has been devastating for the on-premise trade. There were points of time in most states where restaurants and bars were completely closed down to try and push the curve of coronavirus contagion down to the fullest extent possible. Even at this point, when some states have opened up, they've done so more for restaurants, because the theory is that people go there to eat as well as to drink, and it's not really the same environment as a bar. So because bars are just for drinking primarily, there's a sense that they're more prone to maybe an environment where irresponsible behavior will occur as a result of relaxed attitudes, which sometimes occur depending on how much you drink. And as a matter of policy, as a matter of health and welfare policy, many states have decided we'll let restaurants open, but we're going to keep the bars closed. My own state of Florida, for example, has closed all the bars. And many of those bars are teetering on bankruptcy, or maybe already have closed their doors. And what that means is their employees are out of work. They've stopped paying alcohol taxes to local governments, which are already strapped for money. They deny consumers an outlet or an opportunity that many of the consumers, especially in smaller neighborhoods, have grown to appreciate and I wouldn't say depend on, but they look forward to. And now those facilities are closed. Even restaurants in states that have been allowed to reopen do so typically on a reduced basis, some fraction of the total number of occupants allowed on the premises. Maybe it's 50%, maybe it's 33%, or some fixed number, you know, maybe no more than 50, or maybe it's a combination of whichever number is less. And that means lower revenues. And it probably is not a surprise, Sarah, to many of your listeners, that in many food restaurant environments, the alcohol side of the menu really underwrites the food.
Oh, definitely.
And without it, a lot of those places close. Again, employees are unemployed. Taxes are not collected because there's no business, so they're not remitted to the local government or to the state government. And that's been really a tough deal for a lot of the retail tier industry. And because of that, some state officials looking to try and ameliorate the situation have decided to basically bend the rules and say, for this pandemic, for this emergency situation, we're going to allow on-premise retailers like restaurants, who typically can only sell product for consumption on the premises, to also sell for off-premise takeaway. A popular phrase now is cocktails to go. It's an initiative that is passed in many states, and it would explain why in your situation, a customer was able to walk away with a margarita. Hopefully it was in a sealed container, which is what most of the state laws require. But they do that to allow these on-premise retailers some source of additional revenue to try and stay open.
Yeah. And do you think that, you know, as more restaurants start to open and if things start to go back to normal, that this change will become permanent, or do you think that it'll revert back?
Well, that is a great question, Sarah. I think it depends on two variables, politics and money.
Okay.
The politics have
like
to
everything.
I think that's true. Like everything, the politics have to do with the relative strength of the feuding interests. You know, liquor stores and off-premise retailers are not going to be keen to see on-premise retailers have the same privileges that they do, because that means now these restaurants, these hotels, they're going to be competitors, these nightclubs. And I think the off-premise retailers will be pretty strident in saying, this is not the way to go. We've got to return back to the existing regulatory system. The pandemic has abated. Let's do what we should and get back to regular regulation. The restaurants, the nightclubs, the hotels, on the other hand, haven't gotten a taste of new off-premise privileges and being able to say, look, the sky hasn't fallen through. Everything is operating normally. This actually just gives consumers more options than they had before. What's the downside? We should modernize. We should get with it. This isn't 1935 anymore. And there's going to be a fight between those vested interests. The politics will be for the people who decide these questions to listen to the public as well as to the vested interests and make a decision on that. Money, of course, seems to always find its way into the decision-making process, whether, you know, it's in the form of one special interest pointing out to how their ox is going to be gored and their economic losses will be severe if they have to go back to the way it used to be, or if they don't get to go back to the way they used to be. And sadly, for better or worse, the involvement of money in politics these days seems to be so pervasive that the party who marshals together the greatest pot of campaign contributions towards the decision makers seems to have an outsized influence in the decision making process. I don't say that with any pride or joy. I wish it wasn't true. And I listen to arguments that tell me it's really not, but I see a lot of empirical evidence to suggest that it is.
And it just sounds like it's a like one more way that even state and local areas will differ from one to the next. You know, you have one place where you can do your cocktails to go, and then you drive 30 miles, and in the next town you won't be able to do that. And so it just seems like another way things will be more different, more diverse.
I think you're right. The one difference in this ongoing, long-standing battle of vested interests is that the pandemic actually provided one side an opportunity to say, well, let's see what happens if we do this. And I think I have not seen a whole lot of data yet to suggest that there have been substantial negatives coming from allowing on-premise retailers to make off-premise sales. But I have to quickly caution that all the data are not in yet. I'm sure there are going to be studies to see if there are higher incidents of drinking by minors, if there are higher incidents of vehicular-related incidents, crashes, deaths, fatalities, or injuries that are alcohol-related. I think there will probably be some studies to analyze to what degree the retailers on premise benefited from these programs mm-hmm. versus the degree to which the off-premise retailers saw their own fortunes fall. Maybe they didn't, but maybe they did. And I think those data would be relevant to a decision maker. So we'll see what happens.
Interesting. Well, this has been really, really awesome. Before we wrap this episode up, do you have any final thoughts or anything else you want to add?
Well, I have to say that as we started out with, it's a fascinating area of law.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you are correct in saying there's a lot of change that's going on now. And it's likely to continue as the very nature of our society changes, either yeah. because of technology or the relationship of consumers to sellers, and really the relationship to products like alcohol and maybe even products like cannabis as it emerges into legalization. So it's a fascinating area. Great place for an administrative lawyer of regulated products.
Yeah, there's lots to keep an eye on. And thank you so much for being here today. It's been such a good episode. For our listeners, I will post a link with Mr. Blau's bio in the episode notes in case anyone's curious about him or his work. But that's all I have. Thank you again.
You're most welcome.
I would like to extend a sincere thank you to the ABA Administrative Law Section. I also want to thank the ALR Exec Board and staffers, as well as Sharon Wolf, Professor Jill Olmsted, and Professor Andy Popper. Lastly, a huge thank you to Shabir Hamid for editing this podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and the ALR website. We would really appreciate if you could like, rate, and subscribe. If you would like to be a guest on the episode or have any comments or questions, please email them to me, Sarah, at ALR-SR-TECH-EDITOR@WCL.American.edu. The email will also be posted in the episode notes, along with any links referenced in this episode. Thank you for listening. I am your host, Sarah Canarzer, and this has been A Hard Look.